Let's say I have a few bucks in my pocket. Want to get a cup of coffee? It's a pretty basic transaction, right? And in one way or another, transactions are a part of our everyday.
Yeah.
This bloke won't haggle.
Won't haggle?
I'll have a hamburger, for which I will gladly pay you Tuesday.
Let's make a deal!
Yeah, okay. That's what we're doing. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of May 15th, 2015. This week, we're talking transactions. Big ones between nations, or in a veritable pinwheel of baseball players where somebody gets tossed in at the end. Yes, we will explain the player to be named later. Or even trying to go cashless at the vending machine. So let's get started. Transactions can feel like everyday banal stuff. Money we exchange for lunch, the mortgage, or taxi. But often they lead to more. Tommy Andres is a producer for Marketplace, and he's been collecting stories that start with the simple exchange of money. Welcome, Tommy.
Thanks, Lizzie.
All right. Tell us how you came up with this idea.
So it actually all starts with a family story, my brother and his wife, Karen, and how they met. It's pretty insane. It's sort of a confluence of commerce and serendipity.
So lay it out for me.
So my brother was living in Milwaukee, and he had this friend, Richard, and they got tickets to a Bucks game.
Okay.
And they end up sitting next to this girl wearing an Indiana University sweatshirt. And Richard, my brother's friend, went to IU, so, you know, they start to chat. My brother barely says a word, maybe hi, I don't know, that's it. He didn't think anything of it. And then 3 weeks later, my brother's coming back from Thanksgiving, and he's at Metro Detroit Airport, a totally different city, and he sees that same girl in that same Indiana Hoosiers sweatshirt. And here's what he said.
I'm not normally the kind of guy to go over and talk to random strangers at an airport, but I recognized this girl and went over and talked to her.
So he introduces himself, she recognizes him, and they start to talk, and then this happens.
And as we were getting on the plane, I said, well, have a nice flight. And she said, yeah, have a nice flight. And we sat down in our assigned seats, and I sat down in 8C, and she sat down in 8D.
So they talked the whole flight. They exchanged numbers. Long story short, they end up falling in love. And 5 years later, Richard, the friend who was at the Milwaukee Bucks game with my brother, ends up marrying them.
I have goosebumps, actually, now on my arm and down my back.
It's kind of insane, right? So here's what Karen, I actually talked to her, too, for this story. Here's what she says about the whole thing.
I totally, by chance, sat two seats away from him at this Bucks game.
In an arena of 18,000 people.
And then 3 weeks later.
On one of the busiest travel days of the year.
We're seated next to each other on an airplane. This is so cliched, but it really kind of felt like it was meant to be.
Yeah.
So think about this. I mean, if either of them hadn't bought these tickets to the Bucks game and, you know, also on this flight, they never would have met. And what's crazier is if she hadn't been wearing that sweatshirt that she bought, he never would have recognized her. So that's three purchases that impacted their entire lives. And now they have a kid, you know?
Wow. So, okay, you know this story in your family lore, but why make it a series for Marketplace?
So what fascinates me is how a simple exchange of a good or service can actually be the impetus for something that totally changes your life.
You brought another story with you today, so I want you to play it for us.
Yeah, this one's a little different. Let's take a listen.
My name is Tracy Cambry Morales. I live in San Diego, California. And in late 2013, my husband and I decided that for my 50th birthday, we would take a family vacation to Kauai. For almost a year, we planned our trip. We read Yelp reviews, we printed out New York Times articles, 36 hours on Kauai. Needless to say, we were excited about our trip. The plane tickets were purchased, the condo and car rental were secured, we were set. And then in late August, my mother-in-law's health took a turn for the worse, with her doctor informing us she had perhaps 2 months to live. We're a very close family. When we asked her, you know, what can we do for you? She replied, just be with me. Well, my husband and I sat our three kids down and told them we'd have to postpone our trip to Hawaii. I was sad about losing my mother-in-law. I was sad about canceling the trip. I was so sad. I called the airlines. I canceled the rental car. And then I sat down early on a Sunday morning to compose an email to Doug, the owner of the condo on Kauai where we had planned to stay. Dear Doug, regrettably, we are not going to be able to make our trip to Kauai as planned. We learned that my mother-in-law's health was on the decline. Hospice informs us she could live anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months. We just don't know. That said, I understand I am out of pocket for the $1,494 rental fee, but would imagine the security deposit and cleaning fee would be reimbursable to me. Please let me know. We've been dreaming of enjoying your Kauai condo for so long. Thanks again. Maybe 3 minutes later, I received this response from Doug. Hi, Tracy. So sorry to hear the news. Don't worry about the rental fees. I'll return the full amount to you. I understand what your family is going through. My wife was diagnosed with ALS last year. It's the kindness that sees us through the tough times, so I'm always happy when I get the chance to do the same. Appreciate the beauty in each day. Doug. I was stunned. My eyes immediately filled with tears. You know, he was going to return the money? I mean, who does that? I got a lot more than roof over our heads on Kauai. This unexpected goodness and this generosity from a complete stranger. You know, I think of Doug and his wife often, and I'm reminded to always pay kindness forward. So I think ultimately this was a transaction all about kindness.
That was a transaction that never even went through. They never got to go to Hawaii.
Yeah, I mean, Doug and Tracy never even met. And yet Doug found a way to change Tracy's outlook on life, you know? And that's kind of what the transaction's all about.
And that's what our series is about. So, Tommy, thank you. And if you've got your own transaction stories, you can tell us about them. Just go to marketplace.org/transaction. Some transactions are global, like trade between countries. This week, Washington's been in a big fight over considering a trade deal. President Obama fighting his own party, and lots of debate about what free trade means for all of us. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is covering it and joins me now. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Lizzie.
Okay, so we've seen all this back and forth in Washington this week. Senate Democrats voting against the president, then sort of coming around on trade. What is all this back and forth, and why should my mother be paying attention to what's going on there?
So the back and forth this week was specifically about whether or not to grant the president this power to go out and negotiate trade deals and then bring them back to the Congress and have the Congress vote them yes or no without amendments, no filibusters. That's kind of what we were seeing a lot of back and forth on this week. But what it's really about is free trade deals and these deals that we have in the works already with about a dozen countries in Asia, the Pacific, and another one in Europe. And so this kind of procedural vote on this authority for the president actually became a referendum on a much bigger issue, free trade.
And this is an interesting thing because really going back to NAFTA and for a lot of people in the shadow of the recession where they hear words like outsourcing, we talk about winners and losers in free trade. So what does all of this mean for the average American?
Globalization is happening with or without free trade deals. So that outsourcing, that is not dependent on these deals. But for example, if I'm an Alaskan fisherman, I might be interested in selling my fish in Japan. And I might be looking at this Trans-Pacific Partnership and saying, huh, sure, great. If I'm a farmer in Ohio with a soybean crop, I might be thinking, good. If I'm you and me and I'm at Best Buy looking at a new phone, you know, what it means for the average consumer. Here's Derek Scissors with the American Enterprise Institute.
People who like free trade like imports. They think imports make our lives better. Our phones are imported. Our TVs are imported. Clothes are cheaper for poor people because we have imported clothing. People who don't like trade think imports take away American jobs. And that's what they see when they see imports.
And we've had this whole list of concerns really articulated by the left.
Right. President Obama has been more aligned with Republicans on this issue than he has with members of his own party. And Democrats have a long list of concerns. You know, some of them are just, you know, we do not want this. Some of them come down more on the position the devil is really in the details. Here's Simon Johnson, a professor at MIT.
One view, which is the traditional view, and that's the one where we're just reducing our tariffs, that view is, hey, trade is good. Let's do more trade. That's better. The other view, the second view, the view that wasn't in the original NAFTA, but that has developed, particularly on the left side of the political spectrum, that view is, well, you know, trade is good for both parties when the rules are good. We don't want to be encouraging suppression of unions. We don't want to be encouraging workers to get massively mistreated. We certainly don't want to be encouraging child labor. So let's, in our trade agreement, have rules around all of those issues and the environment. And then let's make sure that people actually follow up with their commitments.
And another big issue in all of this has been currency manipulation, basically whether countries devalue their currencies in order to make their exports cheaper and therefore more competitive.
When you bring up currencies, this is also a very important time for us to talk about the strength of the dollar, something you and I use every day. Right now, the dollar is extremely strong. Put that in context with our imports and exports for me.
So when the dollar is strong, what we're talking about is it's strong relative to other currencies. So our dollar is strong. That means other currencies are weak. That means the goods that those other countries are selling gets cheaper and our goods get more expensive. And so therefore, you might be an American consumer looking at a car and thinking, oh, I can get a better deal on an Asian car right now than I can on an American-made model. That might be good for you as a consumer, but if you're someone who works for a U.S. automaker, that's not so good.
You basically just made the economy collide with real life. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Talking about transactions in today's show, but before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and serves them up at marketplace.org. Here are digital producers Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe with this week's numbers. Hit it, Tobin.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
100%.
Sales for Tom Brady branded merchandise doubled this week. That's since the NFL slapped the New England Patriots quarterback with a 4-game suspension for his role in Deflategate.
$179.4 million.
That's how much a painting by Pablo Picasso fetched in a Christie's art sale this week. That number shattered the previous record for the most expensive painting sold at auction.
It also helped Christie's become the first auction house to have a $1 billion week for art.
$11 billion.
That's how many ketchup packets H.J. Heinz says it sells every year.
It's very likely you've gotten ketchup splattered all over your shirt as you try to rip open one of these packets with your teeth.
So why are those little packets so awful?
Cost is getting in the way of innovation. No restaurant wants to shell out money for something they'll give away.
2 million.
That's about how many AOL dial-up users Verizon inherits in its deal to buy the company.
Which begs the question, who still uses dial-up?
Oil has been getting cheaper, and that's great for most consumers. After all, if you fill up at the gas station, your side of that transaction, what you pay for a gallon of gas, is mostly dictated by the price of oil. But every transaction has two sides. In this story, we're looking at the sellers. I'm joined by Marketplace's Stan Alcorn. Hi, Stan.
Hi, Lizzie.
So we're flipping this around and thinking about the producer's side of the transaction in the oil and gas markets. When you have prices this low, what does that mean for people who produce oil and gas?
Well, to answer that question, I went to Carlsbad, New Mexico, on the border of Texas, and it's a place where there are a lot of people who are on the other side of that transaction. And one guy who I spent a lot of time with was Jake Marbach, who grew up in the area on a cattle ranch, where he still lives, actually. And he got into this whole business a few years ago at the beginning of the fracking boom because someone came to his family ranch and they wanted to buy the rights to drill on some of their land. And he ended up getting a job, and now that's his job. And it's been a really booming industry lately. He had 8 employees working 6 days a week last year when oil was up at $100 a barrel. So it's been a good business for him. But when the oil prices started coming down, he started to get a little nervous, but tried not to worry about it. And then in January, after oil dropped below $50 a barrel, that's when something finally happened. He got a kind of a warning call from one of the oil companies that he works for. And then the next day, the real call came.
The next day, I got a call from a guy higher up in the company and said, hey, stop everything. I mean, shut down right now. And we just stopped. And I was just kind of in a haze there for about 24 hours. And we went, I don't know, probably about a month with no work at all.
What was that month like?
Uneventful. Boring. I mean, there's just nothing to do.
Was it scary at all, though, or did you kind of figure out this will end?
No, I knew when I started this 4 or 5 years ago that these times were gonna, it was gonna happen.
So there you are talking to him. We can hear your voice, and he told you he knew this was gonna happen. All the people who rushed out there to take advantage of the boom, did everybody have this sense that, like, after the boom, there will be an inevitable bust?
I think that the people who are older and wiser did. There's a sense that this is a cyclical business. I actually went to this place where people like Jake Marbach do a lot of their work, which is not actually out in the oil fields. It's in a county clerk's office where a lot of the records are. They go back to the 1800s, some of the land records for these ranches out there. And there are all these big hardback books and deeds and mortgages. And that's where I talked to this guy, Mike Birch, who's been in this business since the 1970s. And he was really emphasizing that these kind of places, they're dependent on an industry that's really unpredictable.
When you have this much money coming into a town and to a county, it really hurts when you don't have, the activity that's been, has been generated in the past. So.
Do you think you'll weather it out? You'll stay here for...
Listen, I've been doing this for over 30 years. I've got a lot of weather on me. Yeah. No, I mean, that's what I've done. I've gone the ups and downs and just survived.
Just survived is not the most, rosy term. And he's in the business, but these boom towns have also had kind of a lot of other things happen to them. Housing and other jobs and money that has come in as a result of the oil boom. What happens now kind of on the other side of this transaction as things go down?
Yeah, it definitely is a place that runs on oil. It's not just the people who work there. It's the restaurants where there are oil people making $500 orders for sandwiches last year.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's a lot of sandwiches. They're not making those orders this year. But there are also some kind of silver linings almost.
Like what? What are those?
Well, so there are difficulties to just being a company in an oil town that isn't part of the oil industry. It's tough for the employers of low-wage workers to keep good people because they want to go work in the oil fields and make more money.
More money.
Yeah. So, I mean, the McDonald's there had a sign up offering $9 to $13 an hour plus vision, dental, and life insurance and free meals. The economic development guy for the city said he'd been doing recruiting for the local Walmart and hadn't been able to help them get employees. The population in Carlsbad has nearly doubled to over 50,000 since the beginning of the fracking boom. And there were no new apartment buildings for a while. There are 3 new ones since the beginning of the boom, but there are more hotels. There are 6 new hotels that have gone up.
Marketplace's Stan Alcorn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Let's say a particular kind of transaction cost as much as $8 billion in fees. That's how much the check cashing and payday lending industries make from low and moderate income customers, according to the Brookings Institution. Despite those fees, what's called alternate financial services remain pretty popular, mostly because they're easy to use. Producer Jenny Ament visited the California Check Cashing Store in Echo Park, Los Angeles. Outside, she met Robin Baker, who said she doesn't do it anymore, but grew up cashing her checks at places like this. Here's Robin's story.
You know, my family was just such a money under the mattress type of... They just had that mentality to where it's you. Everybody just kept track of their cash. And yeah, I remember walking to Lawndale from Redondo Beach just to go to the check cashing place.
They charge fees to cash a check. Crazy fees.
They would totally take stuff out. I can't remember what their percentage rate was. The first legitimate job I had, I would still cash my checks there, and it was not significant enough to where it would deter me from going.
How did your family do things like buy cars?
I came from a really low-income family, so a lot of the stuff that we got was hand-me-down from my aunts, my cousins, whatever. You know, my mom drove a 69 Malibu that she later traded so that we could have a car that was better on gas, and it was very much a bartering and a trade economy on a really, really small scale. I think that a big part of what happens with the check cashing business, because there's still one on this block, and it's surprising, is that you know, you can have crap credit and you can get a loan because at the end of the day, they know they're going to make money off of you. If you're down and out and you really need, you know, money to fix your car and you walk into a major bank, they'll just turn you away. I mean, especially when the economy was real terrible a couple years ago, you couldn't get a loan to save your life. You know, I can get $2,000 and these people are going to give it to me, but I know that if I go to this major bank, they're not going to.
Robin Baker is a graphic designer in Los Angeles. We just heard from a woman who remembers paying a lot just to cash a check. A lot of fees, transaction fees. And we asked you, our listeners, to send in photos of your various crazy fees, and you sent us some great ones on Instagram. Here to dig into your receipts and to tell us why we pay these fees is David Lazarus. He's a consumer columnist for the LA Times and a friend of the show. Welcome back, David.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Fees, right? What are these things? I feel like they are out there lurking everywhere.
Well, some of the fees are actually justified by the cost of the actual transaction, and I understand that. But for many consumers, the fees that really raise red flags are the ones that don't seem to have any rational explanation. Those are the ones that really cause consternation.
Yeah, and we reached out to our listeners who sent us some great receipt pictures on Instagram. I'm looking at one from an electricity bill that has some stuff here like the Four Corners adjustment. That's $1.30. There's an environmental improvement surcharge of 0.1 cents, environmental benefits surcharge, $5.42. Then we got another receipt. This one might be my favorite, from a listener who showed us a balance due of $18.27 with an electronic payment service fee of $14.95. The ratio there is fairly bananas. And then you reported this amazing story about a guy who received a check from a client, and yet he got docked for a fee when the client bounced the check.
Yeah, which is extraordinary. It's not necessarily a new fee, but I think many people would be surprised that it even exists. And in this case, the guy's a bookkeeper here in Southern California. A client, a long-term client, for whatever reason, didn't have sufficient funds in his account, gives him a check, he deposits it, the check bounces, and the guy's bank, in this case it's Bank of America, decides, well, we don't really have the wherewithal to go after the guy who actually bounced the check. So what we're going to do is dock our own customer, our loyal customer who did nothing wrong, and take $12 out of his account just because. And when the guy went back to B of A and said, dudes, what? They said, well, you should have known that this guy didn't have enough money in his account.
So you're supposed to call everybody who writes you a check and say, hey, are you good for it?
Apparently. And apparently that's not going to be an incredible faux pas when you're calling your grandparents and saying, I don't know, Granny. Can you check your account first? I mean, it's incredible. And when I asked B of A about it, they said, no comment, which shows a lot of confidence in their fee. They told me to talk to the American Bankers Association, which I did. They said, well, there's all sorts of costs involved with a bounce check, which isn't exactly true because it's largely automated. And then they said, moreover, well, if you want to get that money back, you're in the best position to go after the guy who bounced the check and demand that they reimburse you for the fee, which is like, whoa, really? I got to be the heavy here?
What can you do if you're a consumer, you know, if you're one of our listeners who sent us these amazing Instagrams of their bills? What weapons do you have at your disposal if you think the cost of the transaction isn't justified?
Well, there's always going to be different circumstances here. If you're a long-term and loyal and customer in good standing with some business, chances are if you see a fee, like say a late fee for something or other, and you call and bellyache about it, they'll probably waive it. I mean, even the upfront service reps, not just the supervisors, but the first line of defense, they're authorized to waive these fees to keep you happy as long as, you know, there's nothing really hinky going on. Otherwise, the main defense that we have as consumers is to be vigilant, to look closely at our statements, to look closely at our bills, check out what fees are being charged. Don't be shy about asking about these fees and asking them to justify the fees. And then finally, you take your business where you're going to get the best treatment. So you vote with your pocketbook. But of course, that's not always possible. Switching banks is very difficult. You can almost never switch utilities. And, you know, switching airplane carriers, that can also be tough. So a lot of these nickel and dime fees that seem to be built into the economic system right now, well, they're just a fact of life.
And David, all of these fees, I suppose, are a reason that we're thankful for you. David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been talking about a lot of different kinds of transactions today. Large-scale international trade, or weird little fees that seem to come from nowhere. But some transactions are still old-fashioned and face-to-face. At the farmer's market, for example, we poke, we sniff, sometimes we haggle. And yes, this is a moment of full-blown public radio-ness. We sent producer Eliza Mills to a farmer's market in Los Angeles to see what she could do with $20. Tell us about it, Eliza.
Picture this. Tables piled high with fruits, vegetables, and flowers, bright berries, fresh eggs, the first peaches of the season. Musicians, chatter, a bubbling fountain, and babbling children. I'm here with my friend Eric to shop for produce and maybe get some deals. Let's meet our vendors.
My name is Rick Dominguez.
I'm Alexis.
Brooke Ramos.
We're at the Silver Lake Farmers Market. We are selling strawberries and blueberries, blackberries, and raspberries.
Right now we're selling a little bit of everything. We have mostly citrus, lemon, lime, tangelos, Valencia oranges. We also have farm fresh eggs, some fava beans, Hass avocados, and some fresh nopales, which is cactus leaf.
At the moment, I'm selling stone fruit, which is the beginning of the season. So specifically, we have peaches, nectarines, apricots. We had some cherries earlier that are already gone.
The strawberries are $2 each or $5 for a 3-pack.
The citrus sells from like $1.50 to $2.50. Our eggs are $7 a dozen. We have our avocados pretty much like around $3 to $4 a pound base. And our lime and lemon are $2.50 a pound right now.
We definitely have our hagglers. It's not too often, but it happens. We would like to be able to be a little bit more flexible, but with the cost of being certified organic and especially the cost of water right now, we have to stand firm if we want to continue to produce.
I can't get like 2 packs for $7.
Nope.
No? How about 2 packs for $7.50?
2 for $9. Of the strawberries. 2 3-packs of the strawberries for $9.
Okay. Do you want some strawberries?
I would have some strawberries.
Yeah. Can we do 2 for $9?
Yes, absolutely.
We actually do have a lot of specials. Like, say, for example, the lemons are $2.50 for a pound. Or if you want to take in bulk, you can take 3 pounds for $5. We also have specials on the avocados. See, they go from $2 each or 3 for $5 or 7 for $10.
Would it be possible to get 6 eggs for $3?
I don't really bargain because I don't have a lot of chickens and I don't have a lot of production. I really don't do deals on the eggs.
What if we were to say, can we have 6 eggs for $3 and then buy avocados?
Well, that kind of works differently too. You know, it just depends. If you're getting like a lot of stuff, I usually like help you out. But if it's just like, I want this for $3, then it's like kind of different.
How about if we got a half dozen eggs and some of the little avocados?
I can do $8 for that.
We are down to $3.
Let's go donut peach.
Okay, donut peach.
What does $2 worth of donut peaches look like?
Considering the size, you'll probably get about 4 of them. They're about 50 cents each. As we get the larger varieties, of course, the more expensive they become. You see that color right there? That's beautiful. That peachy, almost yellow tint. There you go. Yellow nectarines.
We're exploring different kinds of transactions this week, and new technology is changing the way we conduct them when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Make deals, pay bills, win the lottery on your way to...
Payday!
Payday, that's the name of the game.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So we are in the bowels of Grand Central Station
yes.
for an experiment with Apple Pay.
Yes.
So we're going to try out Apple Pay with these vending machines. I'm going to get a bottle of water. You're going to hear the hum of the vending
machines.
Yes,
machine. These are loud vending machines. Now, some of them have like the old-fashioned button with the return my change, and you can insert a bill here. But these vending machines also have, Lizzie, those things that you see at, you know, credit card kiosks and the back of taxis and stuff like that. Looks familiar, right?
And that's where we're going to try and use my phone.
You have an iPhone 6.
Here is my iPhone 6.
Yes.
I put a card on it.
So you're basically ready, and Apple Pay is, of course, it works as part of Passbook, which is the company's storage spot for important things like tickets and coupons, things like that. You have to input your credit cards into the system. You did that.
There it is. It's red.
The number is 64... No, I'm just kidding. So when you're paying, you have to use the fingerprint scanner, which we know as Touch ID, to make the payment. So we're standing here. Should
okay.
Should we try it out?
We've got vending machines that claim to take this.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and get a bottle of water. Swipe or tap card to begin. Okay, it says pay with Touch ID. So put my finger on it. Okay,
cool.
It says your Visa debit is ready for Apple Pay. Okay. So I put it here.
Put it
pay with Touch ID.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's done.
Just
Last transaction, just now.
You're getting a water. How very...
Approved, ready for use. Hold near reader to pay.
I think you may have already paid, so press the button. Try that. Ooh.
Oh. Oh my God, okay. The water came out.
Hey, the water came out. You did it. You just bought something with Apple Pay.
I bought a bottle of water with Apple Pay for $2.50. That is my first Apple Pay purchase.
Congratulations. How do you feel?
A little confused. So you're the expert. I want you to explain to me what I just did.
Okay.
I mean, this is my first time. How widely is this thing being used?
Well, this is a good question, Lizzie, and it's a little bit hard to tell because Apple isn't going to necessarily release the numbers of all the places that are using this. But it has done its work as a company to get partners on board. Obviously, the makers of these machines, or Coca-Cola is a partner. There are other partners like McDonald's, Whole Foods. The partners do have to do some work so that the payment systems...
Yeah, what went into all of that just happened?
Yeah, so the machine has to have special software, and any merchant that is accepting Apple Pay also has to have special hardware and software.
Which they had to put some money in it to make it work.
Exactly, and that's a cost for the merchant. There are other versions of this that we should point out. Google Wallet is Android's version. And it doesn't really work widely in real life yet. There's also a couple other versions. Retailers are working on something called Currency.
Samsung bought a company a little while back called Loop Pay. It could be a game changer, actually, because it already works with the hardware that a lot of merchants have. So unlike Apple and Google Wallet, it doesn't actually use what's called near-field communication technology to make payments. It can actually just interact with the machines that merchants already have, this Loop Pay technology. So Samsung phones might actually be a little bit easier to use in the future.
Okay, so if we have all of these different things, why are they all doing something separate? I mean, for me as a consumer, like, well, why can't I just use one?
This is a very good question, Lizzie. And the dirty secret of mobile payments is that it's not about you and me.
Oh, they don't care.
They don't care. They don't actually care. I mean, listen, they say that it's easier to pay. You don't have to pull your wallet out of your purse or whatever. But it's actually about getting data. And usually, if you want to learn something about your behavior as a consumer, you would go to a credit card company and say, hey, Visa, how do I shop as a consumer? This is how it's always been, right?
So now they know that I'm somebody who buys a bottle of water in the basement of Grand Central Station.
Yes, that is part of it. And interestingly, you know, a lot of these tech companies really want this data because they can use it to nudge your consumer habits, and they can also sell that data to advertisers.
Let's talk about the security of this. This feels a little Minority Report, right? I put my thumb on there. It scanned my thumb. I'm not sure how I feel about the security of all of this or things being, you know, straight up delivered to me.
Yeah, so there's obviously two parts of that. Let's talk about security first. So with security, I think Apple is very proud of the security that it's built into the phone. Obviously, as you experienced, you had to use your own fingerprint to actually make the purchase complete. That's one layer of security. The phone also has special chip technology that's supposed to protect you and can actually kill off some of the information if you lose your phone, for instance, to make sure that people don't get your credit card data off your phone.
That would be bad.
That would be bad. So, you know, companies are getting better at building security into our devices that help to stop this kind of thing. Now, obviously, we've both seen Minority Report, right? So you remember the scene when Tom Cruise's character walks into the mall and, like, there are all these walls that have displays on them and they're all talking specifically to him. So there's this thing that might happen in the future where we all interact with advertising and with companies depending on our location, and they know specific things about us and our buying habits. So imagine like a loyalty program at Target that's, you know, recognizes you when you walk in with your phone and sends a little message to your phone that says, hey, remember those shorts you bought last time you were here? You want another pair? They're on sale? That sort of thing. A lot of us might want that kind of thing, right?
And I suppose if you're the person who doesn't, you can do it the old-fashioned way
and
use cash. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Marketplace Weekend is supported by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions designed to help organizations maximize one of their biggest investments, their workforce. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Zillow, with millions of homes for sale, apartments for rent, photos, historical pricing data, and other resources. Available on Zillow.com or on their mobile and tablet apps. Zillow, find your way home. Dinner Party Download is a fast and funny hour serving up culture, food, interviews, drink recipes, and other elements for a winning dinner party. Find Dinner Party Download on your podcast app.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. London's property market is booming. Investors from around the world are putting lots of money into the city's real estate. And for businesses who are looking for somewhere to set up shop, that can be a real challenge as rents skyrocket. But there may still be bargains available someplace unexpected. Earlier this week, London's Transport Authority held a meeting to drum up interest in a rather unique property. It wants to lease out space in an old underground railway station, which hasn't seen any passengers in decades. BBC business correspondent Theo Leggett has the story of that transaction.
London's Underground Railway, the Tube, is part of the city's nervous system. Deep beneath the streets, it's used by millions of people every day, and its stations are bustling, heaving pools of humanity.
Mind
But this station is very different. A faded sign on the wall says, to the trains, and you can hear them rattle past in nearby tunnels. But the tiled walls are grimy, and you won't be able to buy a ticket, because this station, it's called Down Street, hasn't seen a passenger in more than 80 years. Down Street, in London's plush Mayfair district, closed in 1932. During the Second World War, it found a new purpose, as a bunker for Prime Minister Winston Churchill and his cabinet. And the old tunnels still seem to echo to the ghosts of the past.
The Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization.
The station's elegant terracotta facade can still be seen, but the tunnels themselves are usually off limits. Now London's Transport Authority wants to bring them back to life and make some money in the process.
We've launched a competition to see if we can identify people who can bring forward ideas for how we can bring some of this space back into use.
Graham Craig is Transport for London's Director for Commercial Development. As we wandered through the echoing chambers, I asked him what he thought they might one day become.
The ideas that we're expecting to bring forward, who knows, it could be a gallery, it could be exhibition space, it could be a restaurant. Given the history, given the fact that this is where Churchill's war cabinet met, given the fact it's not been used as a station for over 80 years, I think it would be fantastic to do something that is unique here, something that celebrates the place, the location, the history.
And this isn't the only place you're going to be trying to do this kind of thing with, is it?
We have, we think, six or seven disused stations that we could do something with. Each of them is unique, each of them has its own challenges. We've spent months making sure that we can bring forward a use here.
Of course, property up there on the surface, and prices are going through the roof at the moment. You'd spend millions on a property in Mayfair. What's a hole in the ground like this worth then?
We'll see what happens. I mean, it's not just about making money. TfL has thousands of assets across London. We have very large sums of money. We have to generate some £3.4 billion over the course of the next 10 years. It's not just about making money. It's about making the best use of this space.
At the moment, that potential isn't easy to see. The tunnels reflect their history, sure enough, but they're also dark, dirty, cold and quite oppressive. Yet according to Stuart Robinson, executive director of property firm CBRE, demand in London is so high at the moment, that may not be much of a handicap.
Tunnels underground, even they have a value. We've seen public toilets being used for cafes. I'm sure with a space as big as we have here, there'll be uses such as art galleries or restaurants who at least have a shot at this to try and see if they can make it work, because this is where the greatest focus of demand for property is in the whole of the UK.
So the decaying tunnels of Down Street could soon be given a vibrant new lease of life. If the scheme is a success, more stations and other underground areas should become available. Before long then, investors in London real estate may begin looking beyond houses and offices and start delving into the hidden spaces beneath the city streets.
Today on the show, we've talked about transactions of all kinds and their impact in the economy. But since it's baseball season, we wanted to end on one that you'll hear about during the next couple of months. We're talking about the player to be named later. A big and sometimes confusing deal in baseball trades. Joining us to make sense of this bizarre transaction is Lee Eagle. He's the co-director of NYU Sports and Society. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Great to be with you.
I've always been fascinated with this term. What exactly is a player to be named later?
Yes, the elusive, the mysterious player to be named later. Now, a player to be named later in any sort of sports transaction, any sort of sports trade or deal, is really a future prospect. In a sense, we have two teams. Let's take Team A wants a player on Team B, and Team B is willing to give up that player in exchange for certain considerations. And one of those considerations may be the player to be named later. And there are all sorts of reasons that a trade would happen with a player to be named later as opposed to, let's call it an existing player.
Like what kind of reasons?
The real reason is to finalize a deal, to close the deal. And why there's a player to be named later is because there are certain restrictions on which players can be traded and when they can be traded and what it is that each team wants out of the deal.
One of the things that's so interesting about this, and we're talking about transactions this week, is we're really putting a dollar value on a person.
Yeah, we're really putting a value on a dollar figure on a human being and what that human being can produce.
So if we're talking about a dollar figure, let's say, you know, one of these kind of multi-part deals goes into place. How much is a player to be named later worth?
It depends on how much the player who is getting traded is worth and what it is that the teams value the trade to be worth, that transaction.
But theoretically, millions of bucks, right?
At least hundreds of thousands, and usually somewhere increasingly into the millions of dollars. That's where sports really is at. We're talking about the movement of human beings whose work product is worth millions of dollars. And sometimes teams can bank on that, and sometimes it's a prospect. It's a future look into things, hoping that a player will pan out and be worth millions of dollars.
You know, a lot of us probably saw Moneyball and have this understanding of managers and scouts looking at players and really calibrating their numbers, doing a deep dive. Has the system changed at all the more baseball seems to move toward a statistics-oriented field?
Yes and no, because different teams do different things with statistics. And remember, these are businesses. They're organizations. The executives and the decision makers and the front offices all make decisions different ways. And some of them go very statistics heavy. Some of them don't really believe in it all that much. And some of them try to play in a no man's land where they think that so many others are doing it, we better do it too, to give the impression that we know what we're doing. The idea of Moneyball, at least the statistical part of it, has definitely changed the landscape of sports and the way that players move between teams.
Why not just name the player? If I'm like, hey, that, you know, up-and-coming shortstop Lee Eagle looks pretty good, why not just put your name on the deal?
If only, by the way, in my case. But the truth is, sometimes teams don't know which prospect they want to select. Sometimes they don't know whether or not the prospect they've identified will pan out. But sometimes it's just that Team A wants a player from Team B so badly, could be for a playoff run, could be to round out a roster. Team B just hasn't identified, for any number of reasons, how it wants to round out its roster. So they'll just say player to be named later as part of the deal.
Trade deadline this year, the end of July. We going to see some of these floating around?
You can almost bank on it. You can almost bank on it being the case that there will be some players to be named later in a deal. And that could be player movement at any level. So it could be a player worth millions and millions of dollars who gets traded for another player and a player to be named later and even some cash. So there are a number of ways to involve a player to be named later in a deal. It's all about, like almost any transaction, what one party wants and what the other party wants and if they can come to a deal.
Lee Eagle is a clinical associate professor at NYU's Tisch Institute and co-director of NYU Sports and Society. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on today.
That's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll explore exclusivity and how we do or don't buy VIP. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. This is APM.